Now we're in criminal court. And here comes the judge. We're in criminal court. And this young man, who has been adjudged guilty by a jury of his peers, guilty of murder one, as they say in the crime stories, the judge pronounces the sentence. In this particular case, the law is such that the punishment is prescribed, death. The judge pronounces the sentence. Now the judge steps down, comes around to the other side of the bar of justice, and says, I pronounce the sentence, I'm going to take the penalty. For a moment, the officers of the court are not sure what to do, but because of the weight of dignity of the office of the judge, they take the judge into custody, release the young man, and the judge is taken to prison to await execution. What's the problem with that scenario, if any? Leroy.
The young man is still guilty. And the law and the judge has pronounced the judgment. He's not free to personally go against the law established in the land.
You mean the judge doesn't have the authority to do this? He pronounced the right sentence. I mean, the one that was prescribed. Jack.
What's unjust?
What's unjust? Beth can't hear you.
Beth, it's unjust. because the guy who committed the crime is free.
Well, he's going to be punished in the person of the judge.
On what grounds can he take it from?
Take what?
Take the punishment from him. So why is it just for him to take it, not only for the other guy for free?
Bill.
In that the judge may accept the penalty. I suppose that that would be at least possible. But he cannot, there isn't a way for him to accept the guilt. The guilt still belongs to the criminal. And I might point out, I know this is not a field from the discussion, but it is a field from the scenario. It is precisely at that point the Catholic theology imposes penance. And argues, if my understanding is correct anyway, if I understand it right, that is at the point where they impose penance, because it uses on some way do something to earn your salvation. But in any event, back to the scenario, thinking of that, the judge hasn't the means to receive the guilt. In the case of penalty, I don't see any way for him to receive the guilt. And in fact, probably in that scenario, the guilt of the criminal would only be intensified by knowing not only that he did the crime, but the further he somebody else took the punishment that was right for his, the penalty that was right for his. If there's any sense of repentance at all in the heart, which is another major question.
You're talking there about subjective guilt. His subjective guilt would increase. Not his objective guilt.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the guilt still stands.
Yes.
And, you know, and whatever X value is, but the subjective guilt, the sense of guilt, perhaps is a better terminology to use, would increase, knowing that. Now, the problem, as I said, the problem is the judge has no way to take the guilt. He doesn't have a reason to be relevant. I don't see how he does that now.
David.
Just thinking about this from even last time, there's also the side of, I guess, this being a plaintiff that we haven't really dealt with too much in that. Even if you go to the God-man part, God is the one who's been violated again. And so, in essence, he's the one that's also taking us to court. In the sense that he's also the judge, and he's also probably, I don't know, would be the prosecution. I guess if you take his stance, he could take away the guilt if he dropped the charges after the law was fulfilled. The penalty was taken care of, even by somebody else. The law of the state that, you know, somebody has to die. Could the person who was offended that, you know, say, you know, okay, that's fine, and I'll call it square, even whatever. Is that possible?
You might do that in civil court. It's a little trickier when you get into criminal court.
Leroy.
Well, I want to raise a question as to whether in your scenario.
That's a good question.
Presumably
there have to be people who execute the law, and the question would be, in this case, since this is criminal court, the state would of course be the prosecutor. And the question would be, does the state have the right to impose the penalty upon the judge? That is, to actually execute the penalty. Would it be just for the state to accept his offer, whatever you might call it, and to execute the judge? Or would that be unjust? Okay. Bill.
I mean, just considering tenor of our time regarding the judicial system. That's a whole other subject, I guess. But I would think there would be at least a great deal of cry against that sort of thing.
Against the judge doing this?
Yes. Although the same view of cry would echo against the, or stand out against
but even if it were life instead of the death penalty, there would probably still be a hue and cry.
I
at least at least in Western law. We can't speak particularly concerning Eastern legal codes, but
yeah,
certainly in Western law.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, I don't know enough about the other context
right.
to raise the issue.
Okay. David, did you have a point?
Two questions. They're both essentialistic. You say that the judge could be case would be unjust. So how do we define justice? What is the judge? And how do we define guilt? Because you mentioned earlier in your case that guilt was simply the reliable punishment.
I think I included two ideas in it. Guilt is liability to transgress law, which means, if you break it down, it means if somebody says you're guilty, it means you did it, and you deserve the appropriate penalty that goes with it. So it means both things. You did it, and you deserve whatever penalty is appropriate. Okay? Now, go ahead. Okay, that's a good question. What does it mean to be just, or how do we define justice, or injustice for that matter? Does the idea of justice stem from an innate concept? Is there in each of us an innate sense of justice? However, that's defined. Or is justice defined by law? Or do we mean by justice a equitable or even-handed imposition of law and a equitable distribution of rewards and penalties that are related to law? By justice, do we mean simply equity or even-handedness? Presumably, we mean more than that. If you think of Vlad Tepes, later known in popular myth as Dracula, if you think of Vlad Tepes coming into a town in Romania and saying, impale everybody, even-handedly, you know, equitably, everybody, impale them all, and then sits down and has a banquet in the midst of all the stakes where people are impaled. Presumably we have to go beyond simple even-handedness in the distribution of rewards and penalties. Because we're also talking about justice when we talk about the imposition of law. We even ask the question, is this a just law? Okay? Then we can ask, is this a just penalty? Both. And the question is, what do we mean by just? Again, does it arise out of some innate sense? When we speak of a just law, do we mean, or if we speak of an unjust law, let's test it that way, do we mean that something arises in us, some sense of, say, inappropriateness? Bill.
Well, there must be something connected to that, because we seem to try to objectify justice by the laws that we have. I mean, we don't succeed perfectly, but there's an effort to do that.
If the threefold function of government is first protection, then ensuring cooperation, and then direction of some specific detailed activities in order to get jobs done. if those are the three functions of government, then are laws set up in order to implement that threefold function? In other words, is that what the laws are for, to secure those functions of government? Those three, I think, generally cover the cases. And if laws are set up to implement, to enforce, however we express that, then is justice the appropriate form and implementation of such laws? The laws take appropriate form to the accomplishment of those functions, and the laws are appropriately implemented or enforced, if that's what we mean by justice. Scott.
Yeah, I was just going to point out that it sounds like we're talking about human justice here. Justice within our realm and justice that fits in with the analogy. But I think that when we're talking about justification in God's act, I think his justice is a little bit different than our justice. Our justice is based on what he has put in our conscience, what he has revealed to us in nature, and in Western law, it's even based on the special revelation in the spiritual way. But his justice is based in his character, which goes beyond the revelation that we receive.
Thomas Aquinas' categories, you're not suggesting that God's justice and man's justice are equivocal, totally different in meaning.
Right.
Otherwise, we could join Barth and Boltzmann and
exactly.
So forth. So we're not suggesting that, right?
Right.
But you are suggesting it's not univocal. They're not exactly the same in meaning. You said something like a little different. Is that what you said? A little different. So you're suggesting somewhere between equivocal and univocal, somewhere in the analogical realm.
Yes. I think that might just be helpful in thinking about this illustration that we're trying to employ here, because we're not going to be able to come up with the exact idea of God's justice, because his justice is beyond our justice and probably beyond anything that we can actually formulate in our own finite minds.
But not so far beyond that it slips into this category.
Exactly.
Because if we use the word justice in connection with translating Romans chapter 3, that he might be just and the justifier, the one who believes in Jesus, we're using an English word there.
Yes, and it has to have some meaning.
Yeah.
But the meaning is comes down to us in a form of accommodation, his language accommodating to our minds and using terms which we can grasp and get some understanding of what he's talking about there, but without necessarily having a full idea.
So you're suggesting there are some similarities, but also some differences.
Yes.
Not to put words in your mouth. Bill.
I guess if we're going to think in this direction and differences, we have to think about the fact that man's knowledge at its best is faulty or inadequate, insufficient, unperfect.
Certainly imperfect. Certainly not exhaustive.
But like God's knowledge, on the other hand, is perfect,
totally
exhausted, totally complete.
Right.
And that gives, some way to put it, but it gives him an edge, or a broader understanding, fuller understanding, than we can possibly have.
But fuller understanding, do you mean
that God's understanding is like this, going out to infinity, and that our understanding is somewhere in here, but it is somewhere in here, rather than somewhere out here or something, or somewhere up here or something, that it's
still within the range of God's knowledge, but very partial. See, if you don't do this, somewhere in there, you really come to this. Where there's a totally different, a totally other meaning. And then if we use the word just or justice, then the accommodation that Scott spoke of becomes so radical that you come to what Hodge refers to frequently, Hamilton's a regulative knowledge, where God tells us what we are to believe and what we are to do, but it doesn't really have anything to do with what he is or knows or the way things are. It's just the way he wants to regulate our lives. So it really has nothing to do with what God knows. The problem there is that you run into the question of revelation. What does revelation then mean in Scripture? When it speaks of God's being just and the justifier of the one who believes in Jesus. God is the one who is just and the justifier. But we have to use human terms to express that, and the Bible uses human terms. So we've got to say, hey, if those human terms are totally equivocal to God's knowledge, totally other, then we have no revelation. So either we opt for this or opt for somewhere along this spectrum in here, maybe leaning one way or the other, depending on which way you lean. Leroy.
I think this is going to say sort of the same thing. We're going to say that God's justice is somehow different.
Yeah.
The only thing we can mean by that is that sometimes what we conceive of as justice is false.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because otherwise the idea of God needing to justify what he does in being just and the justifier of one of that state is meaningless. And God wouldn't have to worry about justifying anything. He'd do whatever he pleased.
Yes.
But what he is pleased to do is to justify himself, to show himself to be just in a way that we can understand and appreciate, and in a way that upholds the moral universe.
And some people frankly opt for that. But God doesn't have to justify himself in anything. So they abhor and eschew all theodicy. All attempts to show that God is just.
It's important, especially for unbelievers. Yes. And it's important for a believer, too, when he begins to meditate and think on these things, to understand the beautiful character of God.
Scott.
I guess what I was kind of trying to get at is that it seems to me that for a judge to take someone's penalty in our human system of justice is not just. It doesn't seem to work for a human being, a human judge, to take the man's penalty. I don't think that would meet our sense of justice. But God's sense of justice is beyond, and there's a mystery there, where somehow, you know, he is the plaintiff, he is the judge, and he does take our penalty through imputation, by imputing our guilt to Christ and Christ's righteousness to us. But that's a mystery that we really can't get at very well looking at it in our human terms. I'm not trying to put a discontinuity in that justice. I'm just saying that there's a mystery there that goes beyond our own sense of justice.
Well, in other words, out here.
Right, out there somewhere.
But you're still keeping this in here.
Right.
Bill and then Leroy.
The thing that makes God's justice regarding the imputation of sin, guilt, and sin penalty onto Christ, and why the human judge cannot do that and be just.
Do what?
He can't step down from the bar and take the penalty. He can take the penalty, but he can't take the guilt. I mean,
but he can't. But he can't even take the penalty, can he? Justly.
Yeah, that is right. That is right.
What I mean is, it's not in a vacuum. The state has to execute the penalty, and the state would be immoral in doing that. So he can't even do that justly. Okay.
The thing that separates those things, I think, work, is shown to us in the Scripture. In the Old Testament, on the Day of Atonement, when they had the imputation of guilt of the people to the scapegoat and the sin offering. And that shows us that there's a way to do it. And the way to do it is the one who is the sin bearer, who becomes the sin bearer, and the one who receives the penalty of death, is innocent. Totally, absolutely, completely innocent.
So there's a identification in the Old Testament of the worshiper with the sacrifice in that it's a substitute. The sacrifice is a substitute. And then there's further identification in laying hand on the sacrifice, so really tying them together,
yeah,
and showing this transfer of sin in terms of guilt.
Yes. But that means, remember, the one who is receiving the guilt and receiving the penalty is innocent. See, the judge cannot say that at every point he's innocent of the law. He cannot possibly say that, even of the law that he seeks to execute.
He, the judge, is not innocent?
That's right.
You mean the human judge?
Yeah, that is right. Now God, the eternal, everlasting, omnipotent judge, certainly is.
Innocent.
Innocent. But this judge who wants to take the death of the death penalty for this murder cannot say that he is innocent.
Leroy.
I think the mystery comes in is we don't understand what the penalty is. We don't understand it.
You mean beyond what we explored when we looked at the atonement?
Well, in that illustration, for example, I don't know if obviously Christ has to be innocent, but without trying to make that point, just looking at the other analogy, I don't know if the example of the courtroom scene, I don't know where we are now, sort of going back to the courtroom.
Yes.
The original courtroom scene.
You can bring us back to court anytime.
I don't know if the judge has to be innocent of everything in order to take the next time.
Scott.
I was going to say, as far as being able to understand God's justice, if imputation and atonement are just, if it's just for God to impute Christ's righteousness to us, and our guilt to him, then that justice is more than we understand, which was my point. So it's not saying imputation and atonement are the problems, the things that we're having problems understanding, but they are just, and in that they are just, we cannot understand that part of God's justice.
Leroy.
But I think that is the question. if they're just, why are they just? Because the scripture says that God is just and justifier, the one that they can be. So the example is showing why he's just and forgiving, and why he's just and
the atonement is the solution.
The atonement is the thing that shows him to be just.
Yeah. Well,
that's
because
he's just and forgiving us without faith, he's like a deal with the justice of the news. The news is just. The need for him to execute the calendar is just to be the same.
Well, I think, yes, I think the question then comes, which we've been pursuing, how can God justly do this? How can he justly punish the innocent? And how can he justly impute the guilt of a sinner to one who's not guilty, one who's innocent? That is, we don't see in a human court, we don't see any ability to punish the innocent. Well, we see ability, but we don't see a just ability to punish the innocent. That is, might here doesn't make right, no matter how powerful the judge. And we see no ability on the part of the judge to transfer the guilt of one person to another, even himself. So I think we have to ask in this realm, the analogical realm, does God have, can't say the power, because that smacks of justice being based on power. Does God have the authority to impute the guilt of one to another? Or, to put it in more modern language, does he have the right to do it? And does he have the right to punish the innocent? When in the courts of Israel, where he set up a system of courts with judges who were to judge in his name for him, that would have been an abomination. To transfer the guilt of one to another, or to punish the innocent. Tom.
I think he does have the right to transfer the guilt, because he is the one that has sinned against and violated his character. You know, the law comes from him. He's not, you know, subject to under the law. He's higher than the law. So it's his character that's being sinned against.
So he has the right to impute the guilt of one to another.
I would say, because he can't go any higher. And he's the very thing that has been violated.
And you're not talking about imputing the guilt of one to another, a third party, but, in a sense, imputing it to himself. In other words, instead of a third party here, you're actually talking still about only two parties. God imputes the guilt of another to himself. Pardon? Doesn't seem just. Okay, Bill. Yeah.
You cannot make God higher than his own law. If you do that,
then God can change any time. And I mean, he isn't going to do that, but God establishes level ground for us in his law.
All right, let's back up just a minute before we get too far into this. Bill and others. A.A. Hodge sets forth a classification of the laws of God, which I found over the years to be very helpful. He says that the laws fall into four classes. These are the laws of God, not of man. First, he says, those laws which are grounded in the eternal, the very character of God. Those laws which are grounded in his very character. You could think, for example, in the Ten Commandments of the first commandment or of the second commandment. You could think of the third commandment in terms of his name. So you could think of God's person, you could think of God's worship, you could think of God's name, you could even think of God's day, all right? Even though that's downplayed a lot today, the fourth commandment. Then, those are just illustrations. And then Hodge says, and by the way, that fourth one may partake of two or more of these categories of law. That is, aspects of it may fall in more than one. All right. But that's a technical issue. Secondly, he says there are laws which God has promulgated which are grounded in the permanent relationship of human beings, permanent relationships of human beings, which are true in every dispensation, in every age, the permanent relationships of human beings. For instance, some people ask the kind of question, was it wrong to murder before the Ten Commandments? Well, of course it was. It was wrong to murder before the Ten Commandments. You have an example of that in Cain and how God responded to that. There's real blood guiltiness there. Then there are, in the third class, there are laws which are grounded in temporary relationships of human beings. Temporary relationships of human beings. Things which are true in one dispensation, but not necessarily in another. Temporary relationships of human beings. Although you could get into a big argument here on dispensational issues, it's not really necessary. You can think of the relationships of human beings to each other in the theocracy, not primarily with regard to what is called moral law, which presumably would come into either category one or category two. But perhaps civil law, some aspects of civil law, where you have a change from dispensation to dispensation. Temporary relationships of human beings. Permanent, by the way, means everlasting in the second category. So you have some relationships of human beings, like, for instance, marriage, which obtain during a certain part of human existence and which don't obtain in another part. Temporary relationships of human beings to one another. The fourth category he calls, and this is a very important category, he calls positive enactment. That doesn't tell you much, but that is analyzing the term itself. It's not particularly helpful as a term. Positive enactment.
this really means whatever God says is so at a particular time, is right or wrong, and can be changed at a particular time. It's simply right or wrong because God says so. It's not rooted or grounded in his eternal character, the permanent relationships of human beings, or even the temporary relationships of human beings. It's just right or wrong because God says it's right or wrong. For instance, today you might mix linen and wool. I mean, you know, people making fabrics may do that sort of thing. They even had a material here in the United States called Lindsay Woolsey. Lindsay Woolsey. And personally, I like shrimp. I like it when people buy me shrimp. So it doesn't have the characteristics which kosher food are supposed to have, shrimp. You know, so it's in the time of Israel, as far as dietary regulations, it was strictly verboten. Well, there are some things that are right or wrong simply because God says they're right or wrong. Now, what you've got to watch is mixing all of those four categories together indiscriminately. Got to watch that. So if we're going to talk about laws, we've got to recognize there are some distinctions in the laws that God has promulgated. Some are of permanent duration and applicability, some are temporary. Some are very temporary. Some apply to whole nations, some apply to individuals or groups of individuals. It may be right for one person to do a thing and wrong for another person to do that same thing in a given situation. Or in a different period of time. And that's sort of hard for people to accept if they start out with the assumption that all laws of God are on an equal level as far as applicability and permanence. I think it's very important to make these classification distinctions and to recognize that in Scripture you have the grounds for making these distinctions. But now, if we give that, and you may want to think about that, but if we give that, then when we say that God is under his own laws, we've got to qualify that dreadfully. If God can change positive enactment laws at will, then you can't say that he's under his own laws. Unless you mean that while those laws are in force, God is obligated to them in the sense of maintaining them and in the sense of the guilt and penalty associated with them. That is, as long as they have the force of law. I think you probably have to say something like that. But in that he can change those laws at any time for reasons sufficient to himself, then you've got to see God as above those laws. I think the same thing is true with regard to Category 3. Temporary relationships of human beings. God can change those laws, and in that sense, he's above those laws, although not above them in the sense of
as long as he keeps them in force, he also has a relationship to them of maintaining them and visiting guilt and penalty. He's bound himself over to them, as it were, just as he's bound himself over to his promises. Of course, you may discover that certain promises are like that, too, in categories. Some promises may pertain to certain time periods and not to others. That's a whole question of genre again. Very interesting, too. For instance, are all the promises made to Israel available to us today? Does God bind himself to all the promises made to the nation and the people of that nation? Does he bind himself to those promises if Gentiles lay hold of them, so that then God becomes somehow responsible to fulfill those promises to Gentiles? Good question. Second category, permanent relationships of human beings. Is God under those laws, or is he above them in the sense that he can change them? Well, if they're permanent relationships, it would seem that God's word binds him if he has said that they're permanent. And I guess you can say this much, his word binds him as long as those laws are in force. See, you say, but if he says they're unending, they're of permanent nature, they never end in their jurisdiction, then it would probably be difficult to bring in sovereignty and say, well, God can change them at any time. Of course he can, but in this case, if they're really permanent, unending, then apparently he's bound himself over to them. Of course, the first category goes without saying. If they're part of his nature, if they reflect his holy character, then unless we say that God is free from his own nature, unless we say that, that would be freedom with a vengeance. Unless we say that, then we'd have to say either that laws are above God, the first category of laws, and maybe the second category, either they're above God, or they're in God, part of God's character, part of God's expression, if you will, rather than being over him. Then instead of having laws under him or over him, you have the laws in God. So we have to be careful what we do if we say that God is under his own laws. Unless you mean by under that as long as he maintains them in force, he is bound to execute them, or something like that. Questions, comments? Leroy.
I think Bill wants to express how under his laws. I think what would be a proper understanding that is that the first category grounded in God's character, in that sense, he is under his laws. And in that sense, all the other laws flow out. Some of them are against his character. All of them are in his wisdom and his expressed intelligence, are outflows and what it means to govern him, according to his character, according to his understanding of his character.
So all of them are in accord and reflective of his character. All four categories, but that does not mean that in the case of positive enactment, that therefore they must be of endless
force or jurisdiction over men.
Pardon? Well, shrimp.
But even the reason makes it and sets it aside is based on some wisdom.
Oh, no question. They're all reflective of his character in that sense. Yeah. Bill.
I'm real happy with the explanation that the law is emanating from God. That's fine. Because it is true that God is.
I'm waiting for the but.
here we go. Even allowing positive and active categories.
Yes.
We have to be careful not to make God as being whimsical, capricious, or just because I'm the boss type of. God never represents himself that way.
Arbitrariness.
Yeah. He doesn't do that.
But all you're saying there, Bill, I think, is that he has a purpose.
Yes.
Even in positive enactment legislation.
Yeah, that is right.
I don't think we have to argue that.
Okay.
There's a good purpose, a beneficent purpose, even in positive enactment. Even if the Israelites couldn't understand why they were not supposed to do certain things. Even if somebody secretly took a taste of shrimp and said, boy, that's good. You know, even so, they they had to trust that God's purpose was beneficent. And doesn't always mean, some people have jumped to the conclusion that beneficent always means hygienically beneficent. That does not follow.
Yeah, I don't think so.
For instance, if you plow with an ox and a donkey together, put them under the same yoke, you may have some problems. But if you've got a pairing that works, okay? In the Old Testament, you were not supposed to do that. If you do that today out in Amish country, for example, if anybody did that, hypothetically, then there doesn't appear to be any inherently wrong thing in that. And it doesn't seem to be a case of hygiene or something of that sort. The same thing with linen and wool mixed, a blend. But it may have had the purpose of an object lesson amongst many object lessons placed before the eyes of his people that they were to be a separate, distinct, holy people. And that's a beneficent purpose. That's enough of a purpose. You can go beyond that and add certain other things with certain types of food and so on and get into the hygiene questions or the nutrition questions.
But I think it wasn't important to raise because to show that God's purpose is that God is act purposely, he does not act with people. I think that's a very significant issue.
Good.
That as well.
And I think you can take that in all four categories.
Yeah, that is right.
Scott. And then Jeff.
I just wondering when Leroy said that God is under his laws. I was wondering if he was thinking of it in the first way that you have there, or God under his laws, in the sense of God's laws being part of his character. Because I think we cannot, I don't think we can accept the first diagram that you have there of the laws with a line, God under them. Because God is the creator, God is the eternal, God is all, fills the universe. The highest that there is.
This could be expressed in terms of God is subject to his laws. This diagram. God is subject to his laws.
But I think the second diagram still expresses that more accurately because he is subject to his laws because they are flowing out of his character, out of his nature, and a being cannot go against.
Certainly the first categories of the first category of laws.
First category of laws.
And whatever is reflective of his character in categories 2, 3, and 4. But whatever is reflective of his character would really be redolent of category 1 anyway, because you're talking about the character of God, principles of God's own character.
Right.
Jack, and then Leroy. No? Oh, Jack, okay.
Yeah. First you said the laws don't have to be a failure to man.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
I thought I said they don't have to be of hygienic benefit. They can be of...
Okay. You need to put that attitude in there. Hygienic.
Makes a difference.
Okay. Then... But you didn't mean that they didn't have to be at all be benefits. What you are saying, if I put it in there, is that they all have to have some benefits in there.
I'd say they're all purposive. That God has a purpose in each category and in each law. And if the laws are directed toward man and man's relationship to God and to his fellow human beings, then I would say they have a beneficent purpose.
Okay. So, if we look hard enough or if we think carefully enough, we'll find...
I think so.
Yeah. In every one.
In every one. Did somebody else have a hand that I missed? I thought it was Leroy, but apparently it wasn't. No. Okay. What do we have going here then? God, two steps. God imputes my guilt to Christ and Christ's righteousness to me. On the basis of his imputation of Christ's righteousness to me and the removal of my guilt to Christ, God then pronounces me to be righteous, declares me to be righteous. Justification, two steps then. The removal of guilt through imputation, the imputation of righteousness. My guilt to Christ, Christ's righteousness to me. And on that basis, the imputation, God declares me to be righteous.